From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
For over two decades, Israel has cultivated the support of the Christian Zionist movement. Now, Christian Zionism has a Washington-based lobby, and the movement hopes it will rival the power of AIPAC.
Christians United for Israel. We'll speak with investigative journalist Max Blumenthal about a new lobby and its founder, Texas TV evangelist John Hagee.
We gather in Washington, D.C. tonight for one of the most dramatic moments in the history of American Christendom. We gather here from every state in the nation. We gather here with more than 3,400 spiritual leaders. We gather for one purpose, to express our solidarity with the state of Israel and the Jewish people.
Then former Nixon White House counsel John Dean on Conservatives Without Conscience. He talks about his historical research.
The body of science is a study that started after World War II to study authoritarianism, looking to see if what had happened in Italy and Germany after World War II could happen here. And the short answer is it could.
But first, popular Haitian-American folk singer and political activist Annette Auguste, also known as So Ann. She's been released after spending over 2 years in a Haitian jail. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of Lebanese refugees are continuing to return home as a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah enters its second day. Residents of the border town of Ayta al-Shab returned Monday to find it in complete ruins. Entire neighborhoods throughout southern Lebanon have been destroyed. Meanwhile, in Beirut, rescue workers spent much of Monday searching through rubble. Israel continued to bomb southern Beirut up until the ceasefire went into effect. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan praised both sides for largely upholding the ceasefire.
I am relieved to note that the cessation of hostilities in Lebanon, called for by the Security Council, which came into effect at 0500 hours GMT today, appears to be generally holding.
Meanwhile, Israeli cluster bombs are continuing to kill and injure people in Lebanon. One person was killed Monday and at least 18 others injured when Israeli cluster bombs exploded. A doctor at the public hospital in Nabatea warned about the dangers posed by unexploded cluster bombs.
Children were playing or holding something from this munition, and it exploded. One child was killed, and a family of five was wounded.
The United Nations and the Lebanese government have urged residents to exercise extreme caution due to the large quantities of unexploded artillery and mortar shells strewn across the countryside. Last week, the United Nations Security Council called on Israel to provide all remaining maps of landmines in Lebanon. On Monday, Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah told supporters in a televised address that Hezbollah had achieved a strategic and historic victory.
Today we emerged from the battle with our heads high, and our enemy is the one who is defeated and who is now confused in his weakness and who has called for an investigation.
Here in the United States, President Bush rejected Nasrallah's claim of victory.
Hezbollah attacked Israel. Hezbollah started the crisis. And Hezbollah suffered a defeat in this crisis.
And in Israel, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert vowed to continue to pursue members of Hezbollah.
The leaders of this terrorist organization have gone underground and are busy from there in spreading lies and in hiding the truth about the price that was claimed from them and from their men. On this issue, I want to make it clear. These people will not get up free. They will not get off free. We will continue to pursue them everywhere and anytime. This is our moral obligation to ourselves, and we have no intention to apologize or to ask permission from anyone for that.
Aid groups are continuing to send large amounts of food, water, and medicine into southern Lebanon. This is Astrid van Genderen-Stort, spokesperson for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees.
the coming days, we will be needing to preposition goods and to be able to service the people on the ground as quickly as possible, and possibly also with tents. There's probably people going back to their houses, find their houses destroyed, but would want to set up a tent next to it from where they can work on their house.
On Monday, President Bush accused Iran of backing Hezbollah as well as death squads in Iraq.
In Lebanon, Hezbollah declared war on Lebanon's neighbor Israel without the knowledge of the elected government in Beirut. In Iraq, al-Qaeda and death squads engage in brutal violence to undermine the unity government. And in both these countries, Iran is backing armed groups in the hope of stopping democracy from taking hold.
The president's comments came on the same day the U.S. military accused Iranian forces of training and providing weapons to Shiite groups in Iraq. In other news from Iraq, the Los Angeles Times is reporting over 1,000 police officers in Fallujah have left their jobs after receiving death threats. The mass resignation occurred after pamphlets were distributed in the city, reading, quote, "We will kill all the policemen infidels, whether or not they quit or are still in their jobs." The size of Fallujah's police force has shrunk from 2,000 to just about 100. The journalist Jill Carroll has begun speaking about her kidnapping in Iraq. Her newspaper, the Christian Science Monitor, is publishing a 10-part series chronicling her 82 days in captivity. Meanwhile, over the past 2 weeks, six journalists have been killed in Iraq. On August 7th, the editor of a Shiite newspaper was shot in his Baghdad house by gunmen. That same day, the body of an Iraqi freelance journalist was discovered in Sadr City. On July 29th, gunmen shot and killed a correspondent for the Iranian satellite channel Al Alam. On the following day, a Shiite reporter for a weekly newspaper was shot in Mosul. The bodies of two other journalists were found on August 1st. According to Reporters Without Borders, three other Iraqi journalists are being held hostage. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Palestinian gunmen have kidnapped two journalists working for Fox News. The network says it does not know who seized the men, but that negotiations are underway. And in Haiti, the well-known singer and political activist Annette Auguste has been released after spending over 2 years in jail. Auguste, who is also known as Soane, was jailed shortly after the 2004 coup that ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. She was one of the most prominent Aristide supporters to be jailed under the U.S.-backed Haitian government. Last month, Haiti's former prime minister, Yvonne Neptune, was released after spending over 2 years in jail. Supporters of Aristide are now calling on the new government in Haiti to release all political prisoners. In Cuba, more evidence has emerged showing that Fidel Castro is recovering from his recent operation. Cuban television has aired footage of Castro's bedside meeting with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. The two men met on Sunday, Castro's 80th birthday. Chavez praised Fidel Castro's recovery.
Your capacity for recovery is impressive. I remember after you fell. We came here to see you and you were in a wheelchair. Then I came back a few days later and you were already standing.
In Toronto, at the 16th International AIDS Conference, Microsoft founder Bill Gates has criticized the Bush administration's push for abstinence policies. Gates said the ABC program promoting abstinence, being faithful, and using a condom has saved many lives. But Gates said the power to prevent HIV must be put in the hands of women. He said abstinence is often not an option for poor women and girls. Being faithful will not protect a woman whose partner is not faithful. And he said that using condoms is not a decision that a woman can make by herself. Gates said, quote, "A woman should never need her partner's permission to save her own life." In media news, the New York Times has publicly admitted it decided not to publish its groundbreaking expose on the Bush administration's secret domestic surveillance program until after the presidential 2004 election. The paper's executive editor, Bill Keller, said, quote, "The climactic discussion about whether to publish was right on the eve of the election." The paper decided not to run the story until this past December. When the story finally ran, December 16, 2005, the paper admitted it had delayed publication for a year after concerns were raised by senior administration officials. But at the time, the paper did not reveal the story had been held from before the 2004 election. In other media news, a Bush administration official is coming under criticism for regularly appearing as a commentator on Fox News and PBS without revealing her government position. The official, Karen Czarnecki serves as Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Labor Department. She is paid to be a commentator on the PBS show To the Contrary. Instead of being identified as a Bush administration official, she's described as a conservative analyst. On Fox News, Czarnecki has been described as a conservative strategist. The Washington Post reports her television role has been cleared by career ethics staff at the Labor Department. A new government report has determined the number of alleged violations committed by military recruiters has increased by 50% over the past year. The Government Accountability Office launched its investigation of recruiters after an Army recruiter in Houston threatened to arrest a young man if he didn't drop by the recruiting station. Last week, two recruiters in Oregon were disciplined after they tried to sign up an autistic teenager from Portland. In other military news, new figures show that the Pentagon discharged 726 service members last year for being gay or lesbian. That's an increase of about 10% from 2004. In political news, Republican congressional candidates are being urged to portray their Democrats as being soft on fighting terror. On Friday, the National Republican Congressional Committee sent out a memo that read, quote, "In the days to come, you should move to question your opponent's commitment to the defeat of terror and in turn create a definitive contrast on the issue." The memo came just a day after Vice President Dick Cheney said Ned Lamont's victory in the Connecticut Democratic primary over Senator Joseph Lieberman might encourage al-Qaeda types. On CNN, anchor Chuck Roberts suggested Lamont was the al-Qaeda candidate. Lieberman himself warned that Lamont's victory could be viewed as a victory for terrorists. He said, quote, "If we just pick up like Ned Lamont wants us to do, get out by a date certain, it will be taken as a tremendous victory by the same people who wanted to blow up these planes in this plot hatched in England. It'll strengthen them and they will strike again," unquote. In New York, the police department has proposed a new series of regulations that would criminalize many protests in the city. The NYPD wants New York to require that police permits be required for any gathering of 35 or more people on New York streets. Currently, groups can hold relatively small protests, such as picket lines or vigils, without a permit as long as there's no sound system. In addition, the NYPD wants to make it illegal for bikers to ride in groups of more than 20 people without a police permit. Also, the police want the power to arrest any group of two or more pedestrians or cyclists who violate any traffic law rule or regulation. Under the proposed rules, the police could arrest a couple for parading without permit if they jaywalked. A public hearing has been scheduled for August 23rd. In a separate initiative, the Speaker of the New York City Council has proposed that the city's nightclubs be required to install security cameras at their entrances and exits. The proposal has been widely criticized by New York's gay community. One longtime gay activist said the idea smacks of Big Brother. And a memorial service is scheduled this Sunday in Washington, D.C. for Dorothy Rae Healy. The longtime labor organizer, civil rights activist, and radio commentator died last week at the age of 91. From the late 40s through the 60s, she was chair of the Southern California District of the Communist Party USA. She was also a longtime programmer on Pacifica Radio, first at KPFK in Los Angeles, later at WPFW in Washington. In 1951, she and 14 other Californians were indicted and convicted under the Smith Act for conspiring to advocate the overthrow of the government by force and violence. Although she was sentenced to 5 years in prison, her sentence was reversed by the Supreme Court in 1957. This is Dorothy Healy in 1962, explaining why she became a communist.
I was convinced that it wasn't enough simply to view with horror the exploitation of man by man and the horrors that resulted from that, the injustice, the bigotry, the intolerance, the insecurity, the unemployment, that one had to get at the basic cause of why. And I became convinced that the reason was the existence of an economic system that had within it all of these built-in characteristics that provided the horrors of society that I so detested.
And those are some of the headlines. That was Dorothy Healy. Again, the memorial service for her on Sunday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. popular Haitian folk singer and political activist Annette Auguste has been released after spending over 2 years in a Haitian jail. Auguste, who is known as Soane, was jailed shortly after the 2004 coup that ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Soane was one of the most prominent Aristide supporters to be jailed under the U.S.-backed Haitian government. She lived in Brooklyn, New York for 20 years before returning to Haiti in 1994 when Aristide returned to power after the first coup against him. In May 2004, U.S. Marines raided her home in the middle of the night, used explosives to break down her front door, killed her two dogs, handcuffed her five-year-old grandson, and arrested her. She's been in prison ever since. According to the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, the Haitian judge in charge of her case ruled this week there's no evidence to hold her in prison. She was released last night. Soane joins us now on the line from Haiti. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Soane Auguste.
Hello.
It's very good to have you with us.
Good morning to everyone.
How are you feeling?
Good morning to everyone.
How are you feeling?
I feel good. I feel good because, you know, since 2 years I was, you know, sequestered in jail, but now I'm released and I feel well.
You were arrested by U.S. Marines?
Yes.
On what grounds?
The Marine come to my house with grenade. They get everything in my house, you know. Even my dog was killed. They are 15 people, like a 5-year-old guy, 7 years, 8 years, 9 years. That means 15 people was arrested in my house that day. They get everything. They send grenade to my house. No, that means. Hello.
Yes, we can hear you. Can you talk about? Can, yes.
That means. And,
so they arrested
the
you.
Marines, the Marines arrested me that day. Until now, I've been released yesterday. Only yesterday, in 2 years and 3 months in jail. But, you know, they don't have no evidence, you know, to condemn me. That's why today I'm released, I'm free.
And your time in prison, the 2 years, what were the prison conditions like, Soane?
The condition in prison in Haiti is very bad for everyone. For everyone. Even, you know, the mouse, you know, come to your room and, you know, That's very bad. No good food. Nothing is good in the prison. That means everybody is suffering. Everyone is suffering in the prison. So, and it's not only me, okay? There are so many people they arrested, you know, for rats. You know, they call the people rats. Now, so many people were arrested, yes. No, we want all those people who don't have no names. We don't have nobody, no lawyers, you know, to talk for them. But, you know, I really want them to be really sick. Because I got a name, they know me. That there's no authority for them, no.
Why do you think they wanted you to remain in prison?
Because of ICE, because I was afraid of ICE. You understand that? That's my country. Since, you know, you need somebody that's politically healthy. If you are with somebody, you know, they don't want you, you know, to have your own freedom. That's why I defend you in jail, you know, because I didn't do nothing bad, you know. I didn't do nothing bad. I was helping people. They arrested me for what? For ICID. They over to ICID. They sent ICID to South Africa. And I was in jail, that's it.
What will you do now?
From now on, I don't know what I'm going to do because I'm in this country. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know exactly because, you know, whoever is in power now, we're waiting until, you know, something coming good for Haiti because, you know, we struggle, we are going to struggle again. For all those people, you know, they have no food to eat, they have no water, no good water. There are so many people that really need to have to be changed. Because, you know, the people is very, 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 very bad. They have no, lack food. They don't have no school. So many things have to be changed in Haiti. The justice too have to be changed. Everything is there. Yes, it's there. They have no medicine. So many things.
Well, Soane, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Soane Auguste has been freed after more than 2 years in prison. She was arrested by U.S. Marines, taken from her home. No charges were brought against her. Finally, we're also joined by Kim Ives, independent journalist, former editor of the Haitian newspaper, Haiti Progrès. The significance of Soane's release, Kim Ives, coming on the heels of the release of the former prime minister of Haiti, Yvonne Neptune.
Yes, Amy, I think it's showing the importance of the popular pressure which is mobilized now to primarily get the political prisoners out. It must be said that a number of other political prisoners were also released yesterday. There was Zap, who's Yvonne Antoine, a musician who was also in jail. Paul Raymond, an activist who also had been in jail for over a year, as well as Georges Honoré, another activist from Bel Air. So this is showing the power of the movement. Despite the foot dragging of the Préval administration, there has been an upsurge, an uprising of people in the streets every day demanding for the prisoners to be released, and there still are hundreds still in jail.
Well, Kim Ives, thanks for joining us, speaking to us from here in New York. Soane speaking to us from Haiti. Finally, Kim Ives, how unusual was it that Soane was arrested by U.S. Marines in Haiti?
It was extremely unusual. They did this in complete violation of the Constitution, which doesn't allow people to be arrested between the hours of 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. And the fact that they did the arresting and it wasn't the police, they thought she was involved with Muslims at a local mosque and she was going to launch some kind of attack against them, which is so preposterous. She had just come out of the hospital. She had just finished a record. She's 60 years old. She at that time, it was just absurd, and it was extremely irregular for them to go and arrest her and kill her dogs and attack her house military style.
Do you think that the former president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, will be returning to Haiti anytime soon from South Africa, where he is in exile with his family? Kim Ives.
Mm-hmm.
Kim, do you think Aristide would be released?
I hear Soane maybe saying a word about that, but I think he...
Go ahead, Kim.
Okay, I do believe that...
Soane, did you hear my question? Will President Aristide return to Haiti?
You want them to return because the Constitution said that. You don't want to exile people. It's not the right thing. All the people in exile, you know, to have the come back to Haiti because we don't want that. The Constitution said that. No exile people. That's why we want Haiti to come back in the country.
And
this is an organization.
And Kim Ives?
Yes. I think I don't expect him back in the short term, but I do think that this mobilization has such momentum and such determination that I think it's inevitable he must come back in the next few months. He is the symbol that the people still hold of their struggle, of their demands, and I think there's no way, despite the U.S. government's hostility to that project, that he cannot come back in the next few months.
Kim Ives, I want to thank you for being with us. And Soanne, thank you for being with us on this first day of your freedom in Haiti. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, Max Blumenthal, independent reporter, joins us talking about a new lobby in Washington, Christians United for Israel. Stay with us.
Christian cannons have fired at my days, with a warning beneath the holy blaze, and bow to our authority, say the canons of Christianity. Oh, the children will be sent to schools, minds of clay are molded to the rules. Learn to fear all of eternity. Warn the canons of Christianity. Holy hands will count the money raised. Like a king, the Lord is richly praised. On a cross of diamond majesty, say the canons of Christianity.
Phil Oakes here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In March of this year, a study on the role of the Israel lobby in U.S. foreign policy caused an uproar in the academic community and in the media. The paper's authors, Professor Stephen Walt of Harvard University and John Mearsheimer of the University of Chicago, argued that the pro-Israel lobby has unduly influenced the United States to set aside its own security in order to advance the interests of Israel. The study emphasized the activities of the pro-Israel lobby group, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, known as AIPAC. Well, there's another side of the pro-Israel lobby that's drawing increasing attention. Some say it's far more influential. A new group was recently established called Christians United for Israel, or CUFI. They're an evangelical organization that believes supporting expansionist policies of the Israeli government is, quote, a biblical imperative. In a new piece for The Nation magazine, journalist Max Blumenthal reports that group members have held several meetings with White House officials to talk about U.S. policy in the Middle East. They've apparently lobbied the administration to adopt a confrontational posture toward Iran, refuse aid to the Palestinians, and give Israel a free hand in its attack on Lebanon. We are going now to speak with Max Blumenthal in a moment. But first, we turn to Christians United for Israel. Their inaugural event was held last month in Washington, D.C. More than 3,000 people were in attendance to hear speeches from Israeli and American dignitaries. Among the speakers was Kansas Republican Senator Sam Brownback.
Thank you and your energy. Thank you and your prayers. Thank you for standing with Israel in this difficult time. I close with noting that the recently elected Prime Minister of Israel addressed a joint session of Congress about a month or so ago. And he spoke there, and I sat as I listened to him give an eloquent speech, uniting speech, thinking to myself, the United States doesn't have a closer partner in the world than Israel today. And it is true. And it's important for us, when our friend is in difficulty, Israel, that we stand by them in this difficult time. Thank you for being here. God bless you all. God bless the United States of America. And God bless the Israeli people.
Republican Senator Sam Brownback speaking last month at the inaugural banquet for Christians United for Israel. The group's founder, Texas television evangelist John Hagee, also spoke.
We gather in Washington, D.C. tonight for one of the most dramatic moments in the history of American Christendom. We gather here from every state in the nation. We gather here with more than 3,400 spiritual leaders. We gather for one purpose, to express our solidarity with the state of Israel and the Jewish people. Because this historic event is being telecast across the nation and around the world, because this telecast is being seen in Iran, where a new Hitler, the president of Iran, threatens to annihilate Israel with a nuclear holocaust, saying Israel should be wiped off the map, and saying, like it or not, the Zionist regime is headed toward total annihilation, to be ended with a sudden storm. Because the enemies of Israel are doubtless watching this telecast and question our resolve as Christians to stand with Israel until Islamofascism is totally defeated. Because this will be seen in Israel by a war-weary people who at this very hour are once again fighting Hamas terrorists whose covenant calls for the death of the Jewish people and total destruction of Israel. Because God in heaven is watching and has commanded us, keep not silent concerning Israel. Will those of you in this audience who stand in solidarity with Israel until victory comes, stand and send a message to the U.S. Congress, to the people of Israel, to the enemies of Israel. We are with you. We stand with you. Israel, you are not alone.
John Hagee, founder of Christians United for Israel. We're joined now by Max Blumenthal, who writes about Christians United for Israel and New Peace for the Nation. He's a Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. He's based in Washington, D.C. His pieces have appeared in The Nation and Salon, American Prospect, Washington Monthly. His piece is called Birth Pangs of a New Christian Zionism. Explain, Max.
Christian Zionism has been a force within the Christian right for over 20 years. And they've made them, the Christian Zionist movement has made them, they've made themselves an asset to Israel by sending millions in aid money to Israel. They're a major source of Israeli tourism, especially during the Second Intifada. They were perhaps the only source of tourism revenue for Israel, which is a key source of revenue for the Israeli government. And on an individual basis, leaders of the Christian Zionist movement have lobbied the government, especially the Bush administration, which has had an open-door policy to them. But never before has there been a official Washington lobbying organization for the Christian Zionist movement. So now you have Christians United for Israel, which was founded in February by John Hagee, who commands a megachurch in San Antonio with 18,000 members. He's a huge force in Texas politics, a close personal friend of Tom DeLay. And what this organization has done is they've convened all of the major Christian Zionist megachurches in the country under one umbrella group. And they've hired a lobbyist. Hagee has a lot of money through his congregation. And their lobbyist is a guy named David Brog, who's the former chief of staff to Arlen Specter, and he's Jewish. So this makes him a huge asset to this organization because he can beat back criticism from other Jewish leaders that Christian Zionists harbor ulterior motives for supporting Israel, that they have an Armageddon-based agenda for supporting Israel. And if you look at what John Hagee has written in his books, like Jerusalem Countdown, his most recent book, which cites 17 unnamed Israeli intelligence sources to claim that Iran is producing nuclear suitcase bombs and that Israel must engage in a quote-unquote nuclear showdown with Iran or risk committing national suicide. If you look at what he's written, he does have an Armageddon-based agenda. And so I think what this lobby does, it plays an instrumental PR role on behalf of the Christian Zionist movement in preventing legitimate criticism of their motives for supporting Israel, and they are bolstering what AIPAC is doing and possibly even radicalizing what AIPAC is doing by providing them a grassroots base in the heartland. The majority of America's 60 million evangelicals are premillennial dispensationalists. They believe that the end times could come at any moment, and they're looking for signs of that. So they're sympathetic to supporting Israel for these reasons. And so they provide a strong grassroots base. This is the Republican base. This is the only component of the Republican base that still supports Bush's policies in Iraq without question, unconditionally, and supports Israel's expansionism. While the American Jewish community is willing to stand for Israel and show solidarity for Israel, they also support a peace process and they support a sovereign Palestinian state. But this group doesn't. They, for instance, Pat Robertson went on the 700 Club and said that Ariel Sharon's descent into a comatose state was punishment for dividing the land, for the Gaza withdrawal, for pulling 9,000 extremist settlers out of a huge swath of land. And you know, and then last week, Pat Robertson was flown to Israel to pray with Ehud Olmert and then go on the 700 Club and tell his viewership that the Lebanese civilians, the Lebanese society was harboring terrorists and therefore civilian casualties were justified. So they play a PR role on behalf of the extremist wing of Israeli political culture. They're very connected to people like Benjamin Netanyahu, who's positioning himself to succeed Ehud Olmert in the wake of Olmert's possibly imminent resignation. So I think there's a real danger here.
David Bragg is someone you interviewed, Max
right,
Lemon.
Right.
So you spent time with him. You said that he told you during the meetings with the White House, Kufi representatives press White House officials to adopt a more confrontational posture toward Iran, refuse aid to Palestinians, give Israel a free hand as it ramped up its military conflict with Hezbollah, and that the White House instructed Bragg not to reveal the names of officials he met with.
Well, we know in the past that Karl Rove and people in Karl Rove's shop, like Tim Gagline, and Elliot Abrams, who's in the State Department, who's traveling, you know, to Israel with Condoleezza Rice, have met with Christian Zionist groups. So this is not an anomaly, but this group has a much larger voice than any of the other groups that have met with the Bush administration. And they claim, David Bragg claimed to me, that their principal achievement has been keeping a ceasefire off the table for the past month. So their principal achievement has been essentially giving Israel a free hand and the IDF a free hand to kind of, ramp up the war. And I think this has had catastrophic consequences for the Middle East and the peace process. I'm not discounting the influence of AIPAC. I'm not saying that Christians United has anywhere near the influence of AIPAC, but in a Republican-dominated Washington, Christians United represents where the Republican base is at, and that's why you have Sam Brownback going to their banquet. That's why Ken Mellman, the head of the RNC, spoke at their banquet.
I wanted to go to a clip of another prominent member of Christians United for Israel, television evangelist Rod Pardsley. This is an excerpt of his television show, Breakthrough.
I was walking down the road the other day. A woman started screaming, sitting in a wheelchair. She said, God told me that if I ever got near you, I was coming out of this chair. I said, I'm just walking down the street in my blue jeans. Didn't have a choir. Didn't have window. I looked at her. How long you been in that chair? 20 years. Now get over here and put your hands on me. I said, all right, silver and gold have I none, such as I have, not I can work up, not I can go pray down, such as I have, get ready, it's about to fall on you. Give I thee in the name of Jesus. Before I could get my hand on her, she lifted up those legs, kicked the edges of that wheelchair open, and went running down the road, and a police officer had to stop her. He said, what happened? She said, God just brought me out of this chair.
Evangelist Rod Pardsley, excerpt from his television show, Breakthrough. We're talking to Max Blumenthal, who's written a piece in The Nation called Birth Pangs for a New Christian Zionism. Can you talk about the Anti-Defamation League and Kufi and Bragg?
Yeah. Before that, I just want to kind of explain who Rod Pardsley is. He's a really influential preacher in Ohio, and he's the leading force behind Ken Blackwell's campaign there. So I think he's someone who should be watched. He's not as well known as Jerry Falwell, but he's forming a political network in Ohio, and so he's an instrumental player in this movement and in politics in a swing state.
Also has a mega church.
And he has a mega church, and I don't know what he was just talking about there, but he has a more crossover style, so he can reach out to people from the inner city, and he can also reach out to people from the exurbs who are Republicans and the traditional Republican base. So I think he represents a new generation of the Christian right. Last year, Anti-Defamation League President Abe Foxman, the president of the largest American Jewish organization, came out of nowhere and gave a speech attacking the Christian right as the greatest threat to American Jewish interests, to constitutional rights of American Jews. I think it was something that had been a lot of American Jews had wanted him to do for a long time. ADL is principally focused on in the past on supporting Israel and supporting Israel no matter what Israel does, and they've also had alliances. Abe Foxman has had alliances with people like Ralph Reed over Israel. He paid to reprint a Ralph Reed editorial supposedly supporting Israel in a full page of the New York Times in the late 90s. So this represented a break from the past. And Abe Foxman was immediately attacked by a chorus of Christian right criticism, including David Brog. David Brog was one of the first people to attack him. And he attacked him, of course, from a Jewish perspective, saying, evangelicals saved Jews from the Holocaust. We owe them a lot, and they support Israel now. In the Wall Street Journal, in an op-ed, in the most influential, op-ed section for the conservative movement, he was joined by most evangelical leaders in attacking Foxman, and every single one held Israel over Abe Foxman's head and said, "If you continue to criticize us, we will withdraw support for Israel." So it just shows that their support for Israel, or their purported support for Israel, is completely conditional, and that they're using it to weaken the interests of American Jews domestically. And since then, Abe Foxman has been pretty much silent, although he sends fundraising pitches out, warning of the Christian rights machinations. He doesn't speak about it publicly anymore. And on Friday or Monday, the ADL ran these two, I thought, really ridiculous full-page ads in the New York Times saying Hezbollah must be stopped. Well, the ceasefire had already happened, so they'd been stopped. So I thought that was a complete waste of their money. And there is just a void right now in the Jewish community for saying that the Christian right is a threat.
Max Blumenthal, I wanted to end on the issue of rapture. Last month, Harper's Magazine reported traffic on internet bulletin boards talking about rapture end times greatly increased following the outbreak of violence in the Middle East. One person wrote online, quote, "I've been having rapture dreams, and I can't believe that this is really it. We're on the edge of eternity." Another person wrote, quote, "I, too, am so excited. I get goosebumps, literally, when I watch what's going on in the Middle East."
Well, I was listening on July 21st to Janet Parshall, who's one of the leading evangelical and Republican broadcasters. She can get Dick Cheney on her show in a heartbeat. And she said, as soon as the missiles started flying between Israel and Hezbollah, she said, in a voice just brimming with glee, "These are the times we've been waiting for. This is straight out of a Sunday school lesson." So the Christian Zionists have a tendency to celebrate things that most Israelis consider tragic. I question whether John Hagee agonizes over the dozens of deaths of Israeli soldiers. I question whether he agonizes over the Israelis, the thousands of Israelis who had to spend the last month in bomb shelters. I don't think he does agonize. I think what Hagee and the Christian Zionists want is to fight a battle to the last Jew.
Max Blumenthal, I want to thank you very much for being with us. His piece in The Nation magazine is called "Birth Pangs of a New Christian Zionism." When we come back, John Dean joins us. His new book is called "Conservatives Without Conscience." Stay with us. We'll be right back. Arc of the Aorta by Fad Gadget here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. From Christian conservatives to how the Democratic Party has handled the war on Lebanon, last month several Democrats boycotted a speech from Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki after he criticized Israel's invasion. Leading Senate Democrats also wrote Maliki. They questioned his leadership because of the stance on the Israeli attack. But the harshest criticism came from Democratic Party Chair Howard Dean. Tomorrow, we'll talk more about the Democratic response to the situation in the Middle East. But right now, we turn to John Dean, author of Conservatives Without Conscience. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, you come from a very different place.
It's a great setup you just went through.
Talk about, from your vantage point, from the man who spent the last 1,000 days of Nixon's, last 100 days of Nixon's White House with him. Where did you go from there to here, to analyzing the conservatives?
Well, actually, this started about 1994, so it was many years after I left the White House. I did realize after I left the White House and started doing the research for this book that it told me a lot about the White House I worked in. The genesis of this book was, curiously, a longtime friend of mine, Senator Barry Goldwater, and we were talking after the 94 election, where he was actually both mystified and miffed at what had happened to conservatism. He said, "John, I don't understand this incivility. I don't understand why the religious right is dominating the Republican Party." He said, "I'd like to find some answers," and we thought we'd do this book together, and that's where it started. Unfortunately, his health didn't hold up. But later I decided, well, this is a project I just can't drop because I think conservatism is a mystery to me, too, notwithstanding the fact I had been considered myself a longtime conservative, and it was just a different movement than I had any knowledge of.
Talk about your research, going back in time, what social science you drew from.
Right. What happened in looking for answers, I first went down a lot of bad alleys where nothing was there. Then I ran into this body of research that really commenced after World War II, where social scientists were trying to figure out if we could ever have in the United States what had happened in Italy and Germany under Hitler and Mussolini. And the short answer was they found, yes, we could have that. There is clearly an authoritarian personality. The initial research was very Freudian-based. Other researchers quickly who debated that and didn't think that was the most solid began asking empirical questions, asking surveys of people, and developing scales to determine, you know, which personalities were more likely to become followers and those that are leaders. So they did develop. Now we have 40 years of this material, and it has been replicated time and time again. And we know an awful lot about this type of personality. There are people who submit very easily to an authority figure. They do it because they're frightened. 9/11 drove an awful lot of people into submitting to authoritarianism. And they're very aggressive once they submit. This explains a lot of the incivility, the nastiness, the mean-spiritedness. They're not self-critical, and they become true advocates of not unlike the clips you saw earlier in the show, of whatever position they're advocating and pushing.
One of the quotes you begin with is Jonathan Scholl's, "The administration of George W. Bush is not a dictatorship, but it does manifest the characteristics of one in embryonic form," he writes.
Yes, well taken. I must say that as somebody was in a White House where it was dubbed an imperial presidency, which had its own authoritarian nature, we now have a presidency that is the imperial presidency on steroids. They have really bulked it up. It is unchecked by the Congress. I found when I started looking and applying this research, Amy, that it really starts in the Congress, and it blossoms there in the congressional leadership, setting up a very almost dictatorial system within the House. And then when Bush and Cheney come in 2000, they give all this a new legitimacy. 9/11, they exploit that further and give it more legitimacy. And it's a very troublesome thing because it is proto-fascist behavior. Now, are we on the road to fascism? No. The problem is we're not very far from it. And I'm told by the experts in that area that if it comes here, it'll come with a smile on its face, and we'll give up things that we wish we'd never given up.
I'm looking at the cover of your book, Conservatives Without Conscience. You've got a black and white photograph of seven different Republican activists. You've got Scooter Libby, Tom DeLay, Jack Abramoff, Dick Cheney in the middle. You've got Karl Rove, Dr. Frist, head of the Senate, and you've got Pat Robertson.
Yes.
Why this group of men?
Well, the art department selected those out of the narrative, and I think they were pretty good. They ran them by me, and I said those are excellent selections because they're all textbook examples of authoritarian personalities that are employing authoritarian tactics in government. And we don't think of in democracies in terms of authoritarianism. It is very real. It is, has a real presence in government today. It is the controlling group within the conservative ranks. And for that reason, it needs to be watched. The other thing is these people, Amy, don't change their behavior. Once they get into this mold, very few of them can be influenced or told to do anything other than what they're doing.
As you go around the country with your book, you're invited on a lot of conservative talk shows.
Yes.
What is the response of listeners and viewers?
Well, that surprised me more than anything because I understood that a lot of moderates, progressive liberals would say, ah, this is fascinating. This is what we always suspected. And conservatives would reject it. To the contrary, those who I would call thinking conservatives, conservatives with a conscience, are very aware of this problem. They're very troubled by it. There is no question they recognize it. In fact, in doing some of the call-in shows, the hosts have expected me to be barraged by hostile callers. Exactly the opposite have happened, where callers have called and said, John, we realize this is a part of our movement, and we know we're nasty, we know we're mean-spirited, and we do this for whatever reason. So it hasn't been a rejection of it, and maybe it's spread some understanding of it. Another reason, of course, you do a book like this is if we ever have another 9/11, God forbid, it could be worse, and it could drive more people into these ranks.
Do you think Bush administration officials should be tried for war crimes?
You know, that's a question I've been looking and talking to people like John Conyers about the whole question of whether impeachment should be pursued if they gather control. I don't think there's any question in my mind they're going to. Now, whether that'll go the next stage or not to into war crimes or not, I don't think that's realistically going to happen in this country.
It's interesting that the latest news of the Bush administration attempting to quietly rewrite the War Crimes Act.
Unbelievable. I've thought about this. I thought, Richard Nixon in his darkest day, with his worst mood, I can't imagine endorsing or recommending torture. He was in World War II. I watched him handle Mielai and how he felt about that and how he was horrified by it. And yet we have a presidency today that is indeed embracing and still pushing for torture as the norm for how we treat detainees. And it is to me just a classic example of the conservative without conscience. It's the authoritarian. It is worst.
John Dean, you served as Nixon's White House lawyer for the last 1,000 days of
right.
his presidency, among the White House staffers implicated in the 1972 break-in of the Democratic National Headquarters inside
the Watergate
Hotel.
I wasn't the break-in. I blew the whistle on it.
You agreed to testify
right.
To Congress that Nixon was guilty of covering up. Now, how would you compare Nixon to Bush right now?
Well, what I find very interesting about these two men, as somebody who's looked at both presidents pretty closely, I don't know Bush as well, I know his father. What's very interesting about the men, they're two men who use and refer to the presidency in the third person. That's very unique in our presidents. Most presidents, say Reagan or a Clinton, they all talk about themselves as president. These people use the third person. And I began looking at it. Nixon learned about the presidency from Dwight Eisenhower, a man he greatly respected. Bush learned about the presidency from a father, a man he greatly respects. I don't think that either Nixon or Bush quite feel they fill the shoes of the job like the men they learned about it from. There are two men who get out of that office as frequently as possible. Nixon used to go down to San Clemente or Key Biscayne, or he's up at Camp David. Bush is in Crawford. He's traveling all the time. They don't seem terribly comfortable with the office, and that may well affect the way they have run their presidencies.
You also have a quote at the beginning of your book by Professor Bob Altmaier. If you think the United States could never elect an Adolf Hitler to power, note that David Duke would have become governor of Louisiana if it had just been up to the white voters in that state. A lot of people criticize any references to the Holocaust or Adolf Hitler when talking about what's going on in this country.
Well, Altmaier is one of the finest and most leading authorities in this question of authoritarianism. He was most gracious to me to take me where I spent almost a year in this body of science as an outsider. The inexplicable thing to me, and actually to him, is that this science has never been explained outside the academic community, and it's information Americans need. It's something that should be in the public square and for discussion. Altmaier makes that point because it's very real. And he actually, ironically, started writing some of his peer journal material and peer-level books during Watergate, when he was struck at how long so many Americans clung to the Nixon presidency, never willing to say that this man had done anything wrong, down to it gets to about 23% to this day thinks he did no wrong. He said, John, that's a very typical pattern in the demographics in the United States of the hardcore authoritarian followers, that their leaders can do, or their authority figures can do no wrong. They won't question them. They will hang with them forever. They're like lemmings. Unfortunately, those numbers have grown substantially since 9/11. The Republicans, the Bush administration realizes this, not necessarily from this science, but just from their own polling, that fear-mongering works, and they're doing it in spades again. It's going to be the norm for the midterm election.
What do you think of the Republican Party embracing not the Republican candidate in Connecticut, but Joseph Lieberman?
Typical. I think it's highly expedient. Any dissent they can create and cause by making Lieberman into a wedge issue, when it's clearly, not only a statement by the Democratic Party of their position, it's also a very anti-incumbent statement. So I'm sure that they're concerned about the implications of the Lieberman race in the broader context nationally. It's clearly this is a man who's embraced the president, so they're thrusting themselves right into Connecticut politics.
Do you see the country becoming more authoritarian, the government becoming more?
One of the reasons you write a book like this is you hope that you will catch thinking people before they thoughtlessly become authoritarian followers and just say, well, I want the security. I don't care if I'm being wiretapped or my emails are being reviewed by the National Security Agency because I'm too frightened. That really is not keeping terrorism in perspective, and that's exactly what the Bush people want to happen, where we keep it out of perspective.
John Dean, I want to thank you for being with us. His book is Conservatives Without Conscience. That does it for today's broadcast. If you want to read a transcript of today's show or listen or watch the show, tell others too, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Jen Hutes. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, Megan Whitney, Uri Galed, Angela Alston. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.